The standoff between Ukraine and Russia continues. The Crimean region is on a path to break away from Ukraine. Their parliament voted to do that, and a referendum is scheduled for this weekend. But neither Ukraine nor much of the Western world recognize that referendum as legitimate.
The United States is taking steps towards sanctions against Russia and against wealthy Russians affiliated with the government. But there are questions about how effective those efforts would be and whether Western Europe would cooperate.
William Pomeranz joins us now. He's deputy director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Will, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So just 6 days now, by my count, until that scheduled referendum in Crimea. Is this something that anyone in the world, maybe outside of Russia, is viewing as a legitimate election?
No. And in fact, there's been deafening silence in terms of any other country supporting Russia that these results would be legitimate. It doesn't appear that the world is going to be able to stop the referendum. Russia has voiced its desire to proceed. We'll have to just wait and see what happens after the referendum in terms of its consequences for Russia and the region.
And there's been some difficulty even trying to get international attention to that that referendum. A UN envoy chased around by a crowd, difficulties for reporters in the region. Is there any question that this is going to go anyway but a Crimean vote to join Russia?
No, I think that is pretty much an assured result that the vote will go for joining the Russian Federation.
And if that happens, Russia then says, yeah, okay, you're on. Is there anything Ukraine can do realistically about it?
Well, we still have to wait and see whether Russia does, in fact, have the Crimea join the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. And there's questions for Russia in terms of its willingness to recognize different republics and different regions and granting them sort of the right to self-determination. That sort of recognition will have consequences within the Russian Federation. So if there's any hesitation, it will be because of domestic reasons. But as of right now, there's every reason to suggest that Russia would welcome Crimea into the Russian Federation. And no, there is nothing that Ukraine can do to protest, to stop this, other than to protest the development and insist that this is in violation of international law.
So you were saying that maybe Russia might hold back because they say if we recognize the Crimea's right to leave the Ukraine, it might give legitimacy to, say, Chechen separatists under Russia.
One would have thought that would be their reasoning. And for, the better part of two decades, that has been Russia's reasoning. Russia is a great believer in notions of national sovereignty. It hasn't recognized the rights of people to exercise self-determination. And I should emphasize that it's unlikely that Russia would hesitate at this point not to include Crimea into the Russia Federation after it has staked so much on this vote. But what I'm really trying to suggest is that when it does welcome Crimea into Russia and it recognizes the right of self-determination, that is something that will have consequences potentially inside Russia.
Let's turn to the Ukraine side of this now. The Ukrainian government is new, just after ousting the old government, unstable. Is this situation rallying Ukrainians around this fledgling government?
I think that there is an argument to be made that yes, that Ukraine has never been as united as it is today in light of the potential threat that Russia poses to Ukraine's national sovereignty. There are various vulnerable regions in Ukraine, in the east, and in Odessa, where there are a lot of Russian speakers. I should add that many Russian speakers can be and are Ukrainian nationalists themselves, so one shouldn't assume that just because they speak Russian that they're necessarily pro-Russian or pro-Russian Federation in this particular instance. But yes, the actions of Russia, I think, have united the people of Ukraine around this government, although there have been protests. And the crucial issue is that this government, as an interim government, has to get to presidential elections as soon as possible, so the question of legitimacy is put behind them.
Let's dig a little deeper into Putin's motivations here. He has said many times that he regrets the breakup of the former Soviet Union into a bunch of separate countries. Is he thinking maybe in the long term of trying to rebuild it a little bit here, a little bit there?
Well, I don't know if he's really thinking of rebuilding the entire Soviet Union. What I think happened is that the possibility of losing Ukraine from the Eurasian bloc was just simply too much for Putin, and therefore he felt compelled to act in light of his own worldview. Ukraine posed various challenges to Russia. It was about to sign this EU association agreement that would have created a free trade zone between Ukraine and the EU, and that would have posed various sorts of economic threats on Russia. But it also, the association agreement also posed, as it were, an existential threat to Russia, that it couldn't imagine that it would lose Ukraine from its general sphere of influence.
That's a phrase I wanted to bring up, is sphere of influence. This isn't necessarily a desire in the long game for Russia to bring more pieces back under Russian direct control, but they view this as their playground, their economic zone, too.
Well, they do, and they've been trying to convince Ukraine to join the so-called customs union, which is leading to a broader Eurasian union. But Ukraine has hesitated, and Ukraine has hesitated because such a closer relationship with Russia would hurt its ability to pursue European markets. So they're trying to make their own cost-benefit analysis as to where to go and to what economic relationships to pursue. Ideally, Ukraine would want to pursue both. It's in its interest to have good relations with Russia, to have extensive trade with Russia, but it's also in its interest to increase its trade with the EU. And what has occurred here is simply it has Ukraine's kind of realistic decision has been now overwhelmed by Russia's zero-sum game analysis.
Putting this in context, is there anything we can learn from the Russian military intervention in Georgia back in, I think it was 2008?
Well, I think the Russian military has improved over the last 5 to 6 years. There's been a lot of investment in it. The performance of the Russian military during the Georgian War by experts has been judged as not a great effort, but it was enough to kind of restore order as it had existed previously. The question really is, can the Russian military engage in major operations in Ukraine? We don't know the answer to that. We do know that if they were to do so, they would be met by serious opposition from the Ukrainian military. Now, the Ukrainian army is smaller than the Russian army. It's probably less well-trained, but there is no doubt that Ukraine would put up a very strong resistance to any move by the Russian military inside the country, outside of Crimea. Crimea becomes a different case by itself, but any further incursion into Ukraine.
There are a number of small countries probably watching this very closely. I'm thinking of former Soviet states like Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. Are they watching this thinking, gosh, could we be next?
I think they're watching it very carefully. All three of those Baltic states are now a member of NATO, and the NATO guarantees of security would immediately come into play if there was any attack against the Baltic states. So I think they're watching these events with great concern. There are various sorts of stories coming out of potential threats from Russia to the Baltic states again. But these states have joined NATO. They are members of the EU. So the costs for Russia are much higher in this particular instance than would be Ukraine, which is not a member of NATO.
We're breaking down the latest news from Russia and Ukraine with William Pomeranz of the Woodrow Wilson Center.
We're continuing our conversation about Russia and Ukraine with William Pomeranz of the Woodrow Wilson Center as Crimea approaches a weekend referendum on leaving Ukraine and joining Russia.
You can join in with your questions and your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Well, I wanted to touch on what, if anything, the United States can do here. We're hearing from the president sanctions. They're working towards some kind of sanctions, possibly targeting not the country as a whole, but individuals, wealthy individuals connected with Putin. Do we have a lot of leverage there, though?
Well, we can introduce sanctions that target individuals, and it's been very interesting because the loudest cries from Russia have been over the possibility of introducing sanctions against individuals around Putin. So clearly these individuals want to still have access to their money. They still want to be able to go to the West and visit their money. So clearly sanctions do have an impact, and that is what is producing the largest cries from Russia. But there is a question as to whether targeted sanctions can really reverse what has happened in Crimea. That seems to be much less likely. And it will be very difficult to get the EU and the United States to agree on harsher sanctions, I think.
Yeah, the EU is more economically interconnected with Russia than we are. In part, some of the countries there, I think, rely on Russia for natural gas. Winter's not quite over yet. How much of a factor is that in Western Europe's thinking?
Well, I think it's a real factor. And yes, Western Europe and parts of the of Eastern Europe get significant amounts of their energy from Russia, and therefore they simply are not in a position to cut off relations with Russia in response to the actions in Crimea. That being the case, various threats from Russia will encourage these countries, I think, to go seek out other sources of that energy. Russia is a bit heavy-handed in how it deals with its customers, especially when it threatens to cut off supplies. And that, since this is a market, as best they can, I think countries in Europe will now begin to seek out other sources of energy as best they can.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Prairie du Chien. Joe, hi.
Hi. My question is, when are the next presidential elections in Russia, and how is Putin's policies, or how are Putin's policies playing out with the Russian electorate?
Well, Mr. Putin does not face the electorate again until 2018. He was elected in 2012 to a six-year term. That is a result of a reform of the Constitution. It used to be that they were elected to four-year terms, but that was expanded to 6 years. So he has a long time before he has to face the electorate. Not surprisingly, the Russian electorate has rallied around Putin during this crisis, and there isn't really a strong opposition that one could really imagine that could dislodge Mr. Putin in the short term. The real issue is to what extent these actions have economic consequences in Russia. The Russian economy has been faltering. It's on the edge of recession. And if there is a real economic downturn, that will be a real test of Putin's system. And so far, Putin has enjoyed the fact that he has increased the standard of living. We'll have to see what happens if he now finds himself fighting inflation and a decrease in standard of living, and what sort of electoral consequences that would have.
And how vulnerable is Russia's economy to the kind of instability the occupation or annexation of the Crimea might involve?
Well, that's a very interesting point, because Russia is much more integrated into the world economy today than the Soviet Union ever was. So clearly Russia will feel various sorts of economic pressures as a result of their actions. One of the big problems for Russia is really a disastrous level of capital flight. Last year, more than $60 billion left the country. It's been reported that upwards of $20 billion left the country in January alone of this year. This is the money that Russia desperately needs to revive its economy, to diversify its economy, and to grow. So if the response to what Putin has done in Crimea is to increase the level of capital flight, then the Russian economy will suffer. And that would also put more pressure on Putin in the medium and long term.
Is that capital flight foreign investors saying, maybe we don't want to invest in Russia, or is that wealthy Russians trying to shield their money outside of the country?
It's primarily the latter. It's Russians trying to get their money out in various ways. I think foreign investors, over the last year, there has obviously been a decline in all the emerging markets, and Russia is no exception. But I think in light of what has occurred, I think Western investors will yet again rethink their strategies in Russia. One of the interesting responses of the Duma to this whole crisis was to threaten the confiscation of the property of Western investors if sanctions were imposed. Western investors don't like risk. They don't like to hear the word confiscation. And as a result, that could also have a negative impact on foreign investment in Russia.
We'll go back to our callers now. Ben is with us in Green Bay. Ben, hi.
Hi. I think it's really interesting what the Western NATO will do when Crimea inevitably, I think, obviously, it seems like they will approve the referendum to join Russia this weekend. It seems like they're very tied into Russia. They seem very favorable to passing that referendum. So what happens when you know, does Russia then just automatically decide that they want to annex Crimea? You know, it's really interesting to see what's going to happen and find out. I'd like to make a recommendation about a news source that I've been really following. It's called Vice, V-I-C-E. They've been doing some really refreshing on-the-ground eyewitness reporting from Crimea. So thanks.
Ben, thanks for the call. So, yeah, what can the international community do that we're not doing, that they're not doing now, if, in fact, Crimea becomes part of the Russian Federation?
Well, I don't see what the West can do militarily. Ukraine is not a member of NATO. This is occurring in Russia's backyard. Russia has already has the troops on the ground. It already has bases in Crimea. There is very little, I think, that one can expect the U.S. to do militarily in response to what is going on in Crimea. I think it will depend on what we talked about earlier on sanctions and the market, and whether the market begins to elect not to invest in Russia.
I kind of want to ask a couple questions about intentions here. Was there a plan on the shelf, do we think, that Putin had, saying, if such and such happens, we'd like to end up with Crimea? Or is this just an ad hoc, improvised response to what happened in Ukraine that led them kind of one step at a time to this situation we're in now?
Well, it's obviously difficult to know, but in reading the various press reports, and there was an excellent article on this by Steve Myers in the New York Times, where he simply, where he argues and shows that this really was much more of an ad hoc decision, that Putin thought that the agreement on February 21st, when President Yanukovych would remain in power and oversee a transition, he thought that was going to hold. It didn't last 24 hours, and after that, he felt compelled to move. It also has an ad hoc feel because Putin let the crisis go on for so long, and that was largely because of the Olympics. He couldn't. All this occurred in the run-up to the Olympics and during the Olympic Games, and obviously he couldn't engage in these heavy-handed tactics as long as the world had come to Sochi to participate in the Olympic Games. So I think this has more of a feel of an ad hoc decision. In his article, Steve Myers says that essentially that he got together with five or six of his fellow security officers and made this decision. And that seems to make sense because he clearly did not have an economist in the room. And I don't think he really had anyone from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs because they've all been trying to backtrack and try to justify something that is very difficult and something that in the past Russia has not supported.
You can go back to the phones. You've got Esty with us in Madison. Hi, Esty.
Hi. I want to ask your guest about the role of the extreme right in the resistance in Ukraine, the Svoboda Party, and its Nazi-wearing uniform members, and the fact that they have a fairly significant number of members in the Ukrainian Congress, and they have several important ministers. I read a letter from the president of the World Jewish Congress to the Patriarch of the Ukrainian Church talking about young Ukrainians wearing the dreaded SS uniforms with swastika clearly visible in their helmets.
Esty, I want to jump in and give Will a chance to respond. That's been an accusation from people around the world, including the Russians, that there is a strong nationalist, extreme nationalist element to the Ukrainian protests.
There is an extreme right in Ukraine, just as there is an extreme right in Russia and in several other of the neighboring republics. Yes, the Svoboda Party has been represented in the Supreme Rada, and there is a real concern about whether Ukrainian nationalism could overwhelm what is about to occur in Ukraine. There have been some very interesting polls leading up to the presidential election, and what's been revealing is, in fact, that the far right has polled very poorly. Svoboda and the private sector, which is another far-right group, I think got no more than 4 or 5% of the national electorate. So it doesn't look like, at least at the present time, that they're going to kind of ride their way to a presidential victory. But this is a very issue of great concern. As opposed to the question of anti-Semitism and so forth, in fact, several of the leaders of the current interim government are Jewish, and various prominent members of the Jewish community have written to Russia and to President Putin saying that there has not been an increase of anti-Semitism and that they feel quite comfortable living in Ukraine.
Historical view here. We're closing in on the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, where basically a bunch of world leaders bungled themselves into a manner of war that nobody expected or wanted. I don't know, maybe I'm being overdramatic here. How worried about are you about ad hoc, improvised responses here leading to something much, much worse than we have today?
I think that is a very real concern. Obviously, any sort of incident, either in Crimea, in Donetsk, in Odessa, anyone who kind of takes the law into their own hand, the random shots and so forth, this could raise the level of tension dramatically. And that is why it is so important to try to find a diplomatic solution. How we address the issue of Crimea is going to be one that will test the international community for years to come. But we're not going to be able to stop this referendum that's taking place on Sunday. And we're probably not going to be able to stop Russia, if it wants to, somehow annex Crimea. But steps must be taken to defuse this crisis and not let it spread and not let some sort of wild shot anywhere in this region spark a larger conflict.
Will, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was William Pomeranz, Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center.